You are listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprungs disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprungs with a positive message throughout.
Hello and welcome to episode 106 of Tom's Hirschsprungs podcast. I'm very glad to be joined by Karen this morning, and we're going to talk about your son. So welcome to the podcast, Karen.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming on. And I think as we were talking a little bit before, I think one age group that doesn't get massively represented on this podcast is that sort of 18 to 25 age. And your son is 19, if I'm right in saying.
Yeah, he's just about to turn 20 in a few weeks.
Fantastic. So I think this age range is, I mean, it's such a difficult age range to talk about. But at the same time, I think it's really, really important for people to hear a little bit of maybe what the future may hold, or, you know, what your son's been going through. So I guess it's kind of up to you where you'd like to start. But yes, over to you.
Okay. So Kai was diagnosed, we never left hospital. So when I gave birth to him, so he was diagnosed at 16 days old. Predominantly he didn't pass any meconium, and it took a couple of times for me to be listened to. I was quite a young mum. I was 23, and at first, because his stomach had swollen up so much, it looked like the only way I could describe it probably was be like a red cricket ball. It was so swollen and distended, and he wasn't feeding properly, but they kept saying, you know, let's go away, try and feed him again, and come back and see how he goes. And it just wasn't. And it wasn't until I had an amazing midwife who come back on shift, and she was like, no, there's something going on. And they took him away for scan imaging, and it just revealed like he was just totally like, he had like toxic gases. And at first they thought it was cystic fibrosis, because they asked if that was any family history. So at first we thought we were dealing with that. And then there was like, no, it's definitely something else. So we was transferred at the time we was in Kent. So it was Lewisham Hospital. And that is where he had his biopsies done. And then he was diagnosed with Hirschsprungs after the biopsies. And we were quite lucky because the consultant there was one of the surgeons that could do pull-throughs or the operations on small babies. He had to be viable. He had to be like a viable weight for them to do it. And when he hit the mark at 16 days old, again, you don't know how much it is affected. So it was all, we was going in blindsided. We didn't know whether it was going to be short segment, long segment, total. So that was quite a difficult time, because he ended up being in surgery for about 12 hours at 16 days old. So that was probably the most difficult, I would say, time. So yeah, he had his surgery. So he had his large colon removed, and we was told after, I think we was in hospital for about a couple of months in total, but when he come home he kept bleeding, just wouldn't tolerate the milk, so and projectile vomiting. So again, we was going back, and he would have like more scopes and things like that. They thought that maybe something more was affected. But then they started making his milk up at the hospital, just to take him off everything. So basically it was just fats and nutrients. So we started with that. Then it seemed to settle a little bit. And then, of course, weaning, it started up again. He was just going through, just, I can't even explain the amount of like nappy changes and things like that that I had to go through, even to the point of when you have a newborn, like you always have like one ear open, you always listening out for them. But it was almost as if he wouldn't wake up. I would literally, I would hear him go to the toilet, pick him up out of bed, change his sheets, change his nappy, clean him down, and then put him back in the bed. And sometimes I would do that 2-3 times a night. It was just awful. Like he just wouldn't be able to tolerate anything. And that actually went on for up until he was probably about 4 or 5 years old. He wasn't fully out of nappies until he was about 7, because he just couldn't tolerate anything. And in the end, we was transferred to Great Ormond Street Hospital when he was just under 2. And they, I must say, obviously we was just speaking how they've been like my safety blanket for, you know, 19 years. They have been my, if I was worried about anything, I could be straight on the phone, or I would have letters. So if he was ill, I could go to A&E and they would call his team straight away. So I've always had that kind of comfort blanket. So he had a couple of more, I say operations, but they were more like biopsies, scopes to see what was going on with his bowel, because he just wasn't tolerating anything. Where up until about 18, he was on a dairy, gluten, egg and wheat-free diet. Wow. So, I mean, now vegan is quite known, and there is so many foods available, but 18, 19 years ago, there was nothing. So I would have to make his food from scratch, absolutely everything. Just like little things. I remember him when he was about 5 or 6, he'd never had a McDonald's or any, and his sister, who's 16 months younger than him, wanted a McDonald's. So what I used to do is I used to make, for example, the chicken nuggets and chips, and I used to go and get the Happy Meal box and then put something in it so it wouldn't be, and then I would put the food in it so it would made him look like he had had a Happy Meal, and we'd go in the restaurant and eat it just so he had that experience. I mean, it was just little things like that, and I was like, oh my god, you haven't even, you know, had these little, I know they're not massive things, but they remember things like that, don't they?
That's brilliant. I love it.
But it was by advent calendars, I would have to take all the chocolate out. I mean, it was really bad for me because I'd have to eat the chocolate.
I mean, someone has to.
And I would just put his chocolate in there, and so that he would have an advent calendar, because there was no advent calendars around for vegan or dairy-free 18, 19 years ago. So, you know, things like that I would have to do. Because any time we reintroduced food, I mean, we was under dietitians and nutritionists, he would just bleed. His bowel was just so sensitive, we just couldn't get him to a point of he could eat something. Even traces, he would either throw up or it would be like the other end. And it was just really a tough time. We was under Great Ormond Street, as I said, for quite a few years. And that's how it's basically been for his life, basically. We have tried introducing foods, and it just is an absolute no-no. It just doesn't agree with him, unfortunately. And he has had a couple of bouts of colitis, like Hirschsprung colitis. He had an adult form of an ulcer when he was about 7, 8. We was it was over Christmas time, actually, and it was a couple of days before Christmas, and I was just begging. I was like, it's just that any way we can get him home for Christmas. And luckily, they sent me home with the medication, but then we had to go back during the Christmas week just so that they could monitor him. But yeah, it's been definitely an eye-opener. As I said to you previously, that the topic of poo and stools is quite an open conversation in my house, and I'm quite open to talk about it. So I think because Kai does have autism and development needs as well, it's been quite difficult sort of and actually, I know that we are going to go on to genetic testing, but looking at research, there is quite a lot of research with Hirschsprung's and autism that are linked together, isn't there? I'm on quite a lot of support groups, and I would say probably, 80, 90% also have autism, some sort of development disorder with Hirschsprung's. It's quite a high number.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's been a lot of research on Hirschsprung's and Down syndrome.
Yeah.
And I know that there's a link. I can't remember the exact facts. I won't quote them because I can't remember them exactly. But there's a lot of research in Hirschsprung's and Down syndrome. Possibly not as much, certainly from what I've seen, in autism and Hirschsprung's. But that seems, yeah, a lot of very large percentage.
There is quite every person that there's the odd child that just has the operation and they're good to go. I do know a couple like that. I mean, there's, a couple on the support group that they've had no problems. They've just had the operation and they've been good to go and they've been absolutely fine. Unfortunately, there are just so many children that either get missed or do have development disorders or other things, medical disorders going on with it. My doctor, my GP, actually missed a case of Hirschsprung's disease. So when Kai was poorly, he was always so on it. He would always be so, and if I was ever concerned, bring him in straight away because he was so paranoid about missing and, a case of Hirschsprung's again. So he was really good with his care as well. But I think as he was getting older, things did get more challenging because he was at school and I would have to, his care plan would obviously go over to his school. Kai was in special schools. He did start off in a mainstream, but he just didn't cope very well. So he was transferred over to special schools. It's just you're having to trust somebody else. I think that was because I've always been his main carer. It was trusting somebody else that they would sort of be on top of it because, I mean, you probably, yourself that as if you get ill, then it usually goes to your stomach. That's how it would work with Kai. If he ever, especially in the winter, we used to really suffer in the winter. If he ever got even a cold, it would just go straight to his stomach. And I was always so, although you can't wrap in cotton wool, I was always sort of so aware of things. And if there was a bug going around in school and things, I would always be made aware by sort of the staff because it would just make him so ill. And I would probably say half of the time he would need to go into hospital because he would just get so poorly.
Yeah, I mean, that is a tricky one, especially wintertime. I mean, everybody's susceptible to more bugs throughout the winter. But I think because we're sort of immune compromised, aren't we, a little bit?
Yeah.
A lot. The bugs and whatnot are
can be a little bit more serious for us than maybe the average person.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. It really is. So Touchwood, as he's got older, it's got a little bit better. I think as he's grown, I mean, he's quite, he's, I think, about 5'11", and he's quite well built. So that's always helped him. He will eat anything that you put in front of him. So he's quite, he's a typical boy like that. I say boy, but he's a young man. But yeah, he eats quite well. Before we left Great Ormond Street, we reintroduced little bits. He can tolerate traces, but dairy is a complete no-no. Still just cannot tolerate dairy at all. So we've just, you know, accepted the fact that he just can't tolerate dairy, and traces of things like wheat and gluten will they'll upset him a little bit, but it's where he can probably tolerate it a little bit. So for example, I don't know, if he went to a birthday or something and wanted, I don't know, a bit of some food there or something, and he knew he would probably have a little bit, but he would probably pay the consequences the next day. But whereas dairy, it would really upset him. So he knows, I think that scarred him for life, and not to go near dairy. But yeah, I think it's hard because, as you say, when you hit puberty, your hormones and things like that, once that all kicks in and they're having to explain to them about their condition and having, they need to try and be independent with managing it. You probably know with yourself, and hard because, I mean, he was a very quite angry over it when he was younger because he couldn't eat the same foods and things, you know, even things like school Christmas dinners. I used to cook a Christmas dinner and then drive it to the school so he could eat the school Christmas dinner with all of his friends because he obviously couldn't eat it. He used to get really angry over it, but I think now he's just accepted. And because things like vegan food is so, I don't want to say fashionable, but it's more aware now, and quite a lot of people do have that diet, he's actually quite okay with it. But we did go through quite a few years of just being quite angry because he couldn't eat food and certain types of food. But I would say as he's got older, I think it's difficult because you can't see everything that's going on. Like, I have to trust his wording, and he'll be like, yeah, mum, it's fine. It's fine, mum. But, and then he might be ill a couple of days later, and I'll be like, okay, obviously it wasn't fine. You probably know yourself, maybe you've done that as well. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a tricky one with Hirschsprungs because I believe that we have a higher pain tolerance than other people.
Yeah.
So what hurts others, or what's, you know, illness to others, maybe is normal to us. So maybe, I don't know, maybe he is kind of going, oh, everything's fine, because it's actually like normal to him, like it was to me.
Yeah.
But for anybody else, they'd be going, oh no, I'm really in pain, I'm really ill. But just because I think we have, because of all the surgeries and the procedures we have, and because the stomach is quite a delicate area just generally.
Yeah.
And you've had all of this invasive stuff. I mean, even if, I say, only just had the pull through, even if you just had one or two surgeries,
yeah,
that's a really invasive procedure.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of work that goes on and into like pull throughs and this, that, and the other. And I think as time goes on, our pain tolerance is pretty high. So maybe we do cover, I know I have, you know, you cover things and you go, oh, it's okay, it'll be all right in a minute, or it'll be all right tomorrow or whatever. And actually, you're really not very well.
Yeah.
But you just get on with it because it's all you've ever known.
Absolutely. And I think that's so true because he has got a very high pain threshold. And he would he, for example, when we used to go in for scopes or biopsies in Great Ormond Street, they would always say he cannot be sedated because he fights the sedation so much. He would have to be put under because he just didn't like being sedated. And it would be, the nurse would be running out as if to say, we need more sedation, because he just wouldn't take it at all. And things like with blood tests, he would... from a young age, he would just walk in and be like, there's my arm, you know, or be like, because my mum is a phlebotomist, and she would always say, because it that's a good vein, Kai, that's a good vein. So we'd walk in and be like, my nanny said that's a good vein. And just, he'll be like, that's okay. So then that always used to sort of soften the blow a little bit. He has got a real high tolerance, and he will always try and cover things up because he doesn't want to go to hospital or he doesn't want to go to the doctors. He'll be like, it's absolutely fine. But I sort of can tell, he gets quite pale, withdrawn. He drinks a lot more. So I sort of can tell when the signs are there. And as I said, the last couple of years, touch wood, he, you know, has got the common cold and seems to have gotten over it quite quickly. But I would say all through like his high school and all school, really, he really suffered. And it would be quite often he would have to go in and be put on antibiotics because it would have gone straight to his stomach. He was just so susceptible to colitis. He was on omeprazole for quite a long time. We weaned him off it, I think, a couple of years ago, just to sort of soften the lining of the stomach, because his stomach is just so sensitive. But I do think, you know, as you say, as you get older, the 18 to 25 mark is developing your independence, like how you're going to manage it. Do you need, you know, do you need other people to help you manage it, or can you manage it on your own? And I think communication and having them conversations can be quite, you know, quite challenging sometimes.
Very.
Yeah.
Very. And I think also, as well as your independence and whatnot, you're also starting potentially a career at that age as well. You know, maybe university or just finishing up studies and this, that, the other. So you've got, yeah, it's a tricky age, I think, for everybody, you know, regardless of, you know, whether you're absolutely fine or you have any conditions at all. But I think for someone with Hirschsprung's, I think that is that's a potentially quite tricky age, I reckon.
Absolutely. And I think if you've had the the care around you, and I was always very good at communicating with Kai, and I never hid anything from him. You know, even if it felt like it was quite scary, I would explain it to him. For example, his scars were always his superhero scars because he got them fighting sharks when he's little, you know, things like that, until we got older, you know, because he'd be like, Mummy, what's some scars? So I would explain it just, you know, as if he was a superhero, until he was, you know, at the age where I could explain it to him about his stomach and what was going on. But I just think you have to prepare them for independence. And obviously, you know, if they're going to university, if they're starting a career, and you know what, how they're going forward in life, how they're going to manage it by themselves.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
With Kai, because his autism is quite, affects him quite socially, he is actually the last couple of weeks just transitioning into supported accommodation, purely because I have been his main carer for, you know, since he, obviously since he's been born, but he needs to start developing that independence for not only his development, but obviously, you know, his stomach issues and things like that. And so we're going through a massive transition at the moment of him going into supported accommodation. The next thing would be getting a job, employment and things like that, just so that he can, I don't want him to miss out, because he's obviously had this unfortunate start in life. I've always been quite a big advocate of, he has exactly the same, you know, whatever he eats, we eat, you know, things like that. Just never wanted him to feel different. So I'm always trying to strive for him to have exactly the same experiences. But it's just obviously managing that, the Hirschsprungs, really, because people say once you have the operation, it's all fine. It drives me crazy when people say that. I think, come and live my life.
I mean, for the very few percent, as you said earlier on, I have interviewed a few people that they have a procedure, a pull through very early on, and then apart from a couple of stomach aches, everything's fine. I mean, lucky them, fantastic. That's very, very good. However, it's really not the case for a lot of us. So I think people kind of assuming that that's the case and that it's quote unquote a childhood condition, when it's not, it's a lifelong condition, I think is a dangerous assumption to make.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Absolutely. And some people don't get, you know, I've heard of a couple of people that haven't had it picked up until adulthood. They suffered their whole childhood and they haven't had it picked up. They've just been put it down to, you know, chronic constipation or, you know, just lots of other different things. But then actually when they've had the biopsies, usually higher up, that they have found something. Honestly, I don't know how people manage. And as you say, you know, great for the people that don't have, they've had the operation and they've gone through and lived, you know, a relatively normal life. But it's been very real. The last, you know, 19, 20 years, it's, you know, usually the first thing I think of, like when I get, you know, has he had his medication? Has he been to the toilet? Has he, you know, is he aware that, you know, maybe he hasn't been a toilet for a couple of days and he needs to make sure that he's going? Or quite a big thing, I think, when they turn sort of 16, 17 is, without being too descriptive, you need to look and make sure there's no blood, there's no, you know, things like that, or it's not diarrhea. And that was a bit of a hurdle to get over, because he was like, oh, I'm not doing that, Mum. And I was like, unfortunately, we have to do that. You know, it's just part of the condition that we do need to do these things, because that can tell us a lot. So, yeah, I think that when he got older was one of the challenges, definitely. I did actually say to you, we did have genetic testing when he was, I want to say he was about 4 or 5. And it come back as just totally sporadic. So it's a class as a sporadic condition, It was just a sporadic thing that happened in his, so it wasn't, neither myself or my husband at the time was a carrier. It was just a sporadic thing that happened. And they basically described it to Kai as an odd pair of socks. And that's how we've described it all through his life, is you've just got an odd pair of socks. And we all love an odd pair of socks, let's face it.
That's, I mean, that's, it staggers me really, the amount of people like Kai and like myself, who have no family history whatsoever.
Yeah.
And just, you know, you're the one in 5,000. And it's just, that's just it. Like, there really isn't, I guess, kind of going back to what you said previously about the sort of anger about the foods he couldn't eat and this, that, and the other. I know one of my issues was sort of that anger of going, well, why me? You know, why am I the one who got it? You know, why? And nobody can answer it. I think that's the real frustration. I mean, even through genetic testing, still nobody can kind of go, oh, it's come from here and it came from, you know, this side and this person, and then it passed down and through, you know, nobody can explain it. I think that's just, it's frustrating.
It is so frustrating. And I went to that appointment thinking that they was going to have all my answers. And when she said, it's just sporadic, it just happened. And I was like, I just couldn't, it took me a while to accept it, because I was expecting her to say, okay, well, you know, either myself or my husband was the carrier, or it's come from X, Y, Z. But she couldn't really give us a lot of information, or the fact that if Kai ever had children, they obviously would be more susceptible to having it. They would have a higher percentage, and then it would obviously move down. And even with me, because Kai was my first child, I was worried about other children having Hirschsprungs, because also that's quite common as well, isn't it? And she couldn't give me an answer. She just gave me percentages that, yes, you are going to have a higher chance of having another child with Hirschsprungs. I had two girls after Kai, and thankfully they didn't have any issues at all. That was one of the first things I said to my midwives, was like, please just make sure they poo. Please, that is the first thing I need to know. But yeah, they just gave us percentages and just said, Kai, you've got an odd pair of socks. And that's the way we've gone through life and said, okay, we've got an odd pair of socks, we can deal with that. But it is quite frustrating, because again, you are the one in 5,000, and it is, I went through a few years of being, why my baby? Why my child? You know, what have I done wrong? Was it something I done in pregnancy? Was it something? And it's just, it's nothing that you could, it's physically out of your hands. You know, at the end of the day, it's physiologically, it's just the makeup, isn't it? And it's just, unfortunately, a genetic glitch, I suppose, that's happened, and you just have to deal with it. And as my mum used to say, although it has been hard and it has been difficult, there are worse things. And you can, it's challenging, it's hard, and there have been days where, you know, I'm like, I'm just physically can't do this. But you know, at the end of the day, it could be a lot worse. So you just have to be grateful and thankful, and that, you know, you can manage it. But yeah, it's not to say that you don't. No, when he has been ill, like very poorly, I think I took it very badly. And I was so, when he first was transferred over to Lewisham, he was really poorly when he was only a few days old. And I think one of the things that sticks with me is, usually if you go into a hospital and you say, they're going to be okay, they're just going to be given some medicine, they'll be okay. And usually the nurse or doctor will be like, absolutely, that's fine. And I think on two occasions, I think myself or my husband at the time said, you know, he is going to be okay. And you've had the response of, you know, your baby's really poorly. You know, we're going to do the best we can. They couldn't give you an answer. And I think that has traumatized me. And it would do. And I think that's where I became like a complete I did mollycoddle him quite a lot in the first few years, and that's, you know, you do, because you obviously you're so worried. I mean, he would only be allowed to drink bottled water, and I used to check his temperature several times a day because I was so scared of him becoming unwell. And I think you hear them words and you just think, okay, this is serious. But it's just been, it's been a change, definitely. Absolutely. I think going through the years, some things have got easier, but some things are also still quite the same. You know, you still have to, you know, manage the condition. He's still medicated. But I'm hoping that, you know, it's always going to be like that, but with some extra support, he will be able to manage it a bit more himself, because it's difficult. You can either go through life, as you say, and just manage it and maybe, I don't know, have the odd stomach ache, as you say, or it's a constant thing that you have to be aware of.
Yeah, you're right. And it's so difficult to give an answer and give that kind of, you know, this is going to be like this when you get to 20. It's going to be like this when you get to 25. Because everybody is different and everybody reacts in different ways. And I think for me, it's just kind of one of the reasons of doing this is just to kind of get more stories out there. So you just have more options as to what life may be like, but we can't say what it will be like.
Because there's so many different types, you know, you short segment, long segment, you know, total, you know, it varies so much that obviously you can't say what it's going to be like. But I think if you can nail what the care, if you can nail the care, I think it does tend to get easier. I mean, it's just natural for me now. You know, it's just one of them things that I always think about, that I've always had to think about. I think it's going to be harder for me to actually hand over to another person, because what do I do? This is what I've done on my life, you know, for the last 20 years, is care for him and make sure that everything, and even, you know, things like appointments and things like that, I honestly don't know what I'm going to do with myself. But I suppose that's part of motherhood as well. You have to let them go. And that's what I really wanted to do. I really needed him to start developing independence, because he does rely so much on me. Not just because of the Hirschsprungs, but because of things like the autism, things like that. He does rely so much on me. He does need to start developing his own, you know, care skills and things like that, and his independence. But again, you know, it's going to be hard, but you have to let them, I suppose you just have to let them go, don't you?
I think so. I mean, I wouldn't know it from a parental point of view, but it just, that's what it sounds like to me, that it's, I think it's tough for any parent to, you know, when the child moves out or whatever. But I think especially if you've been so heavily involved in all of their care, all of their appointments, checking, you know, everything, you know, making sure they're okay with this, that, the other, and then to sort of have to go, right, okay, now they need that sort of semi-independence, but yeah, sort of also knowing that you're there as well.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's not like totally throw them all out and they're, you know, absolutely themselves. They know he knows you're there, and, you know, if he needs questions answering, I'm sure you'll be absolutely there. But it's tough.
It is so tough. It's like, for example, the last few weeks we've had so many appointments, but we've gone from going from Great Ormond Street to having, you know, 3 months, 6 months, you know, 6 weeks checkups type of thing, or I can call and I could speak to a member of the team, the gastro team, to now me having to phone people constantly to try and get something around him. So he's got some type of support around him. It is so difficult. The adult care is just, I'm quite let down by it, really, that I'm having to constantly ring people. And he, from being discharged from Great Ormond Street, we waited a year and a half for that appointment. And he has like a local consultant, but then he also has like a specialist if he needs to go and obviously see them. But again, to get that was, we've waited a year and a half. It's been crazy.
Yeah, and it's unfortunately not an uncommon story from, you know, especially that, but that gap between, you know, when you leave Great Ormond Street or any children's hospital, and then it's into the big world, and that's kind of it. There's no smaller transition into teen hospital or whatever, and then on to, you know, into sort of functioning on your own. And I think, and again, obviously there's funding and this and that and the other, that, you know, that's obviously a massive issue, but it's what happens in those sort of 20s, isn't it? Those early 20s, late teens. And I think that's a really difficult one, because you go from almost your every need being met to nothing. There's nothing in between.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly it. There's nothing in between. And that is where you have to try and pick up and manage and do the best that you can. But it's scary. It really is. It really is scary. So that is where we're up to at the moment. So we're embarking on a new journey. Hopefully it will be smooth as it can be.
Absolutely. And it's been a heck of a journey so far. But just as we wrap up, the future, I know we talked a little bit about, you know, the sort of in-betweeny care that, you know, there'll be, and that he's moving into supported accommodation. But I guess, obviously, you can't see into the future with a crystal ball as such. But what do you hope for Kai's future?
He is a big creative writer, and I hope that he will go into something. I mean, he's so, like, he emails quite often production companies of like ITV and BBC, because he doesn't have that perception, and I love that he has no filter. He will email them and ask for funding for his films. Like, it's fantastic. Absolutely.
Don't ask, you don't get.
Exactly. I'm like, son, I'm so proud of you. If you don't ask, you don't get. And he went to Elstree Studios for an interview for an apprenticeship because he was emailing people. I do hope that he can go into his field of what he loves. I mean, he's obsessed with things like Titanic and Big Ben. He can talk all day long about things like that. And I hope that he will go into that sort of line. He will be able to manage it, I'm quite sure. He will just probably be he will need to be more aware of things, and just to, you know, with dietary needs, and if he's feeling a little bit off and things like that, he just needs to be more aware, because I'm not going to be behind him every step of the way, you know, when he's got a job and things like that. So that's the most important thing, I think, at the moment, is for him to find employment and be settled in his new, you know, when he's moving. My hope for the future for him is to really get into his line of creative writing, because that's all he does, is sit at his laptop and he will write. That's his thing. You know, if he's upset, he's happy, or he just needs a little bit of alone time, he will just write. I hope so. I hope that he will go into that type of thing. I'm sure he will. I mean, he could be emailing Steven Spielberg next. I don't know. Probably.
Well, let's hope so. And I just want to say thank you so much for coming on and sharing what's been an amazing story. And I wish both you and Kai all the very, very best for the future.
No, thank you. It's been really, really interesting to speak to you. And it's been nice to sort of have you know, the conversation with you, because obviously yourself, you're older as well. You know, briefly what we spoke about before. Yeah, it's been really lovely to chat. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio. You can find me on Facebook under Tom's Hirschsprungs Podcast or Instagram on Tom's_Hirschsprungs_podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll bring you another episode soon.